Frank DeFord is one of America's greatest sports writers. He has spent the last half century writing for Sports Illustrated, where he now has the title Senior Contributing Editor. He does commentary for NPR. He does segments for HBO's Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. He's received more awards and written more books than I have time to list. And he was one of the Miller Lite All-Stars in the Taste Great, Less Filling commercials. His latest book is a memoir entitled Over Time. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Paul.
In the book, you write about your career as a sports writer, but you also share stories about a lot of the athletes you covered. And it seems to me that the people have always been much more important to you than the game and the score. Is that right?
Oh, Paul, I never could have stayed as a sports writer, as sort of an expert in some sport, you know, covering games. I have great admiration for the guys who do it, but it just isn't to my taste. It was always the people in sports or sometimes the issues that engaged me, and that's why I've stayed in it for a lifetime and had a wonderful time doing it.
One of the things that you've been able to do is really get up close and personal with people. You talk in the book about being able to go into a locker room with Jerry West and sit down for 15 or 20 minutes. Can sports writers do that now in the 21st century?
No, there are too many of them. In a similar situation, NBA playoff game, they would bring someone like Jerry West or the modern equivalent of Jerry West, LeBron James or whoever, into a sort of an auditorium. And they would speak to us as a politician, you know, a press conference sort of thing.
Yep.
But when I was covering it, you could get so much closer to the athletes. It was an entirely different situation altogether.
So you can't really write the kind of in-depth profiles today that you once could?
Well, I think you can. I mean, there's no question. I mean, just because you can't see a guy right after a game doesn't mean you can't write a profile about him. But by the same token, I don't think athletes are that interested in having profiles written about them today. I think the written word doesn't involve them as much as it used to. It used to be somebody would be delighted to have a story written about them. Among other things, it might help them get a job in the off season when they needed extra money.
Yep.
It's just a different situation altogether. I'm very glad that I was around. Well, let me put it this way. I hate being old now. But I am glad that I was around back then.
Yeah, but you can't get old unless you've had a lifetime of experiences.
And that's right.
You certainly have. So on this theme, I'm curious about the impact of the internet with its instant reporting and, you know, everybody's got an opinion, but everybody has a blog. And everybody always had an opinion, but now they have a place to publish it online, on Facebook, on Twitter. What's that doing to modern sports writing?
Well, it's not just affecting sports writing. I mean, that's across the board. It has changed all of journalism. It doesn't worry me so much that people have these blogs. What worries me is that there's no money to do the reporting that allows people to have the opinions. I mean, after all, that's what blogs are about. Now, somebody has an opinion because of what they've read somewhere else.
Yep.
And if nobody does the reporting, if nobody does the particularly the investigative reporting, then there's simply we've lost so much in journalism, lost what really matters in journalism.
It does seem to me like there's a lot more commentary than there is reporting nowadays in every part of journalism.
That's exactly right. And the commentary is based on what? If nobody's reporting, then the commentary is based on thin air. There's entirely too much speculative stuff out there, and this is true in sports writing, yes, but it's right across the entire spectrum of journalism.
Yep. In fact, one of the cable news channels just put on another one of those panel talk shows where people are going to comment on the news, and the executive producer was asked, "Why aren't you reporting the news?" And he said, "That's not what we're about."
And also, it costs money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem, and. The best journalism, by and large, costs the most money. I mean, you to invest in a big investigative piece, you're gambling, first of all, that you're going to get the information that you want. Often it takes a long, long time to do it. And so that's the first thing that's cut. And it's the most important thing. I mean, that's the scoundrels are going to have a field day now until we figure out how once again to pay for that kind of investigative journalism.
Now, in your years as a sports writer, one of the sports you covered a lot was tennis, and here we are in the middle of Wimbledon 2012, and once again, there aren't many Americans among the highest-ranked players. Why is that?
Well, I tell you, it completely confounds me, particularly on the women's side. On the men's side, I can understand it. You're a young athlete, and you look around, and you see how much baseball players are making, and football players, and basketball players, and you naturally say, well, that's what I'm going to do. But women's tennis is the most popular worldwide sport. It is, and it's where women make the most money. It's the most glamorous of sports. So why American girls are not going into tennis completely confounds me. Some people have said that girls and boys alike in America, it's just too hard. It's a lonely thing hitting that ball back across the net. Again and again and again, or against the backboard. It's just you out there, and it's tough. It's a brutal sport. And so some people have said Americans are just too soft to play it. That's why the Eastern Europeans in particular, and Asians to some in some respects, they're the ones that are playing tennis now.
Yep.
Otherwise, I can't really imagine why Americans aren't playing tennis.
I don't either. My wife and I both play. We both love watching the game and playing the game. And, you know, when Wimbledon comes around, my wife actually is recording, you know, 13 hours a day at Wimbledon and going through it when she comes home. But we have one of those households where the guy has to tell the woman, honey, turn off ESPN.
Well, I mean, right now I think the men's game is spectacular. I don't know if they've ever had such an embarrassment of riches in any sport, where you've got Federer, who's a little bit in decline, then Nadal, then Djokovic, any one of whom could end up being called the greatest tennis player of all time. I mean, you could theoretically have a situation 20 years from now where people say the three greatest players of all time all competed at the same time in around 2010.
Yeah,
I mean, that's possible. It's an extraordinary situation, and of course, none of them are American.
Speaking of tennis, you were good friends with Billie Jean King. You helped her co-write her book, and in your book, over time, you say that she was as significant an athlete as Jackie Robinson.
Oh, I think maybe you can even make the argument that she was more so. And the reason for that is this. And this is taking nothing away from Jackie Robinson. But black Americans were playing sports. Before Jackie Robinson came along, with the whole Negro Leagues, and Robinson himself had been an extraordinary college athlete. It isn't like there had been any prejudice against blacks playing sports. They just needed the opportunity. And Robinson was first, but he needed somebody like Branch Rickey to give him a leg up. Billie Jean really changed the way that girls thought about sports, and for that matter, that we all thought about women in sports. And so I think it's an easy argument to make that she was the most significant athlete culturally of the 20th century.
So isn't it funny that her becoming that came out of an absolute spectacle that night at the Houston Astrodome against Bobby Riggs in his sugar daddy outfit?
Yeah, well, that was the culmination. And that was a terrible situation for Billie Jean, because there was no way she could win, really. I mean, she did win. But had she lost, it would have been terrible. People would have said, well, these girls can't beat any. They can't even beat this old man. She knew that she had to win. And she did. And as a matter of fact, Paul, that was one time where, about the only time in my career, I can't predict anything, that I knew she would win, because Riggs was just having fun. She was playing for a cause.
Yeah.
And the cause that she had worked on for so many years was in jeopardy were she to lose. It really was. And she didn't mess around. If you remember, she beat him three easy straight sets.
Yep. And then that was nearly 40 years ago, and this week we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Title IX, which has allowed kids like my daughter to go off and play as a varsity athlete in high school. Do you think, on the whole, Title IX has been important and good for America?
Well, I don't think there's any question. I think it's been, and the funny thing is that nobody really anticipated when that law was signed by Richard Nixon. Nobody was thinking of athletics so much. They were thinking of equality in many other respects. But nobody sat down and said, you know, if he signs this law, that's going to mean that girls and young women are going to have the equal chances in sports. Nobody really put that together for a while. And I think if they had, I think there would have been a lot of those old athletic directors who would have gotten up on their hind legs and said, well, except for sports. It's been a tremendous thing. It's changed the way that little girls have lived their lives, and it's changed the way that we have thought about women in sports. All for the better. I mean, you know, it's healthy to play sports. You don't have to end up being Maria Sharapova. It's healthy to play sports.
Right. And plus, being part of a team, whether you're an individual who, like a tennis player or a football or baseball player who has to be as part of a team every day, just being out there with other people and doing that together is a different kind of education, but an important one.
Yes, and I think one of the best things, I mean, we talk a lot about how we too much emphasize sports, and we do, but then everybody does. But what's good about American sports, I think, is that we have a tendency to emphasize more team sports than anybody else. I mean, almost everywhere else in the world, it's soccer and nothing else. And here, we have that emphasis that's spread around baseball, basketball, football, ice hockey, in some places soccer. And I think that's a much healthier situation. If a kid isn't good in one sport, he can still be a teammate in another. And I think that really is to America's advantage.
I'm Paul Harris, talking with Frank DeFord about his memoir, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. We mentioned Jackie Robinson a few minutes ago. He arrived on the scene before you started writing about sports. But when you started, the sports world was still overwhelmingly white. And in your half decade at Sports Illustrated, I'm curious about how racism affected their coverage of black athletes through the years. What were your experiences?
We were very nervous in the early years that I was at the magazine in the 1960s, when blacks, for the first time, black athletes really began to become an influence on the court and on the field. What we were afraid of was that white Americans would not buy the magazine if it struck them as too black oriented. And by the way, this was the same attitude that advertisers had and the team owners had. The NBA in particular was panicky that too many black stars was going to turn people off from basketball. And those endorsement products invariably did not go to the best blacks. They went to lesser whites for the same reason. So everybody was commercially, magazines, television, likewise. It was one of the reasons that the NBA had a hard time getting a contract. Well, white Americans don't want to watch a bunch of black guys playing a sport. So it was across the board, this fear that white Americans would not watch sports or would not buy a product associated with a sport or whatever if blacks dominated the game. And to the credit of the fan, this theory was eventually batted down because it didn't prove to be true. And then ultimately, of course, the greatest endorser of all time was a black guy, Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Well, and really, before him, this is something of an embarrassment, but before him, O.J. Simpson. O.J. Broke down a barrier when he became the Hertz, if you remember that, running through airports.
Yes. And in doing so, he was one of those people who helped knock down the bricks of that wall.
Yes, it was. I mean, what happened to O.J. afterwards is, tragic and horrible. But the fact of the matter is, that he proved early on that white people, you know, would buy a product that was identified with the black athlete.
Yep.
I've often said that, the presence of black athletes, the fact that they became ubiquitous, that they were in our lives, in our living rooms on television, that they wore uniforms that said the name of our city or our college, said in a way this prepared us for an African American president. I think it, you know, was one of the building blocks of that.
That sports had that much of a cultural effect on America?
I think they did over time. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Barack Obama is president because of sports. I'm just saying that is one thing. I would also give the same sort of credit, if you will, to Bill Cosby, to Denzel Washington, to Oprah. The fact that black people, black stars, just entered our lives and were there as sort of part of the scenery along with the whites, I think allowed us in a much easier way eventually to accept a black president and other high black officials.
Yep, I agree. Frank, you and I share a problem in that we are both 6 feet 4 inches tall, but when people meet us for the first time, they often say, "I thought you'd be taller." Now, how they get that idea about me from radio or you from print, I have no idea.
I don't know. It's always the case. People say, "God, no idea you were so tall." And as I say in the book, the other thing, Paul, I have never in my life, when I answer and they say, "How tall are you?" and I say, 6'4", I have never in my life had somebody say, "Oh, you're not that tall." They always say, "Oh, you're taller than that."
That's right.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's true. Now, I am skinny with long legs, and so maybe I look taller, but it's one of the great amusements of my life.
So because of our shared height, I was fascinated with the chapter in your book about Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell, who towered over both of us and pretty much everyone else on the planet. What was your relationship like with them?
Oh, it's interesting. I didn't write much about Bill here, even though I've known him. I wrote some about him. But I wrote about Wilt because our relationship changed. And in the book, in Over Time, I was trying to write, you know, stories about athletes as they pertain to me. And Wilt and I had a very interesting relationship in that I really didn't like him and he didn't like me at first.
Sports
Illustrated and by extension didn't like me. And the world was sort of divided, the basketball world anyway at that time, between Russell people and Chamberlain people. That was it. It was just like capitalism and communism. There was no in-between, right?
Right, but part of the reason, Frank, that he didn't like you is because of one of the first profiles you wrote of him where you said his teammates say he smells.
That's right. That's right. And so I guess he had a right not to like me. Not that I said he smelled, but that for revealing that. And so anyway, Wilt's career ended, and I thought that would be the end of anything I would have to do with him. But a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Tommy Kearns, who played on the 1957 North Carolina team, which was the team that beat Chamberlain's Kansas team in the finals in triple overtime of the NCAA championships, which really was the first time that he was branded as a loser, which is terribly unfair. Anyway, Kearns became a friend of his. Kearns, who had played against him in this game, became a friend of his. And he told me, he said, "Frank, you know, you're wrong about Will. He's a good guy." And so the three of us went out to dinner one time. He told Wilt that I was a good guy. And then I did a long story on Wilt. And in the last years of his life, we were very friendly. The last time I saw him, as a matter of fact, was at a party, and he was beaten down, Paul. He had written that silly thing, that stupid thing about sleeping with 20,000 women,
yeah,
which he thought would make people really admire him. And it, you know, it, if anything, it made them disgust him. you know, people were disgusted by it, or at the very least, you know, made him a figure of fun. And he asked if I could help get a documentary made by HBO, his idea being that this would take some of the emphasis off that one aspect and sort of rehabilitate his image. And unfortunately, before we could get that done, he died suddenly.
Yeah. You had done the terrific HBO documentary on Bill Russell, and Wilt kind of wanted that same thing.
He wanted the same thing, but he really needed it. Russell didn't need it.
Right.
You know, there were no flies on Bill Russell, but there were on Wilt, and he felt that if people could look at a whole spectrum of him, and I agree with him, then that stupid business that he had written would be put somewhat in perspective.
Because before he wrote that, the thing that everybody knew about Wilt Chamberlain was the 100-point game.
Yeah, numbers are Wilt. See, that was why the 20,000. You know, it was always like, if I score the most points, if I get the most assists, if I get the most rebounds, Wilt could never understand the subtleties of the game. I always said that I thought he would have been a better individual sport guy if he could just go out and beat people on his own. You know, he was great at track and field, but he didn't do much with it. And then there was that nonsense about he was going to fight Muhammad Ali, but that was just, I think, bar talk.
You actually quote Russell in the book as saying that he thinks that there are times when Chamberlain laid back, like against Willis Reed in the 1970 NBA Finals, that famous Game 6 where Reed hobbles out and comes back in, probably pumped up with who knows what in the locker room.
Good God, yeah.
Yeah, and Russell said, you know, if he were there, he would have laid into Reed, and Chamberlain laid back. Was that part of what Chamberlain felt he had to do?
I don't know if I would have been smart enough to figure it out if Russell hadn't explained that to me. But I think Wilt did feel that he was so strong that he could hurt people very easily. And I think there was a certain pacifism in him. And that he, remember, the great shot that he had was called the finger roll.
Yep.
Which is the absolute opposite of the strong dunk. It was, you know, he just dropped the ball into the basket, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that in many ways symbolizes him. Not that he would dunk the ball, that he would, you know, that was Wilt. Wilt wanted to show people that I'm not just a big giant, that I'm, you know, I have, there's more to me. But I remember asking him one time, I said, there's a theory that you subconsciously miss free throws in sort of to prove that you're not all capable. And he says, people say that? I said, well, I've heard that. And he laughed. He said, no, it's just a head thing. It wasn't that deep. He just couldn't make free throws. It was as simple as that.
Frank, you have written profiles of some of the greats of sports. You introduced the world to Bill Bradley and Bobby Orr when they were just young guys who nobody really had heard of yet. You also wrote the Sports Illustrated cover story on Anna Kournikova, who, of course, became much more famous for her looks than for her tennis talent, and got you branded a dirty old man.
Dirty
right?
old man.
Yeah, why?
Well, first of all, it was a very valid story. She was like, she was like no other athlete that had ever existed. She was that popular. I think at the time that I wrote the story, she was like number four on the internet in the whole world. Okay, including not just people but things. More people logged on in one way or another, clicked on, or however you count that, to Anna Kournikova than anybody else. It was a very valid story, and part of the story was, well, she's not a champion. It's obviously because she's just so pretty, and women didn't like that. They wanted me, or any writer, to concentrate only on who's the best. And of course, we don't do that with male athletes either. We write about the ones who are most interesting.
Yep.
For whatever reason.
Yep.
Maybe they're goofy. Maybe they're good looking like Tom Brady, right?
Yep.
But it was taken that DeFord was sexist, that he was only interested in Anna Kournikova because she was pretty. Well, I was interested in her because she was pretty, and that made her different than anybody else who had ever existed. And the funny thing was, of course, Paul, I mean, at that time, I was in my 60s. Anna Kournikova was 17, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, and I think I had a daughter about the same age. I was dealing with a child.
Yep.
Beautiful child. No question about that. But she was extraordinary, and there has never been another athlete like her. Nobody, male or female, has ever been that popular.
Not only was she popular, but she wanted the popularity to be about her looks when she did the piece and the cover photo, right?
That's right. Walter Yost, the photographer, who, by the way, had shot all kinds of swimsuit pictures through the years. I mean, this is just another shoot for him. I mean, Walter wanted the cover picture to be her playing tennis. And by the way, let me say this in defense of Anna Kournikova as an athlete. She was a darn good player. If she had not been injured, I don't think there's any question that she would have won a major championship. She, I think, got as high as number 3 in the world and was at one point number 1 in doubles. I mean, she was a really good player.
Mm-hmm.
Was she as good as Steffi Graf? No. Was she as good as Martina Hingis, who was also coming along at the time? No. But, you know, number 3 in the world ain't bad.
Yep.
And if she hadn't been injured, I'm quite sure that she would have won some championships. So the idea that this useless player was only pretty is ridiculous. I mean, she was on her own rights as a player. She was a terrific athlete.
Yep.
And just happened to be gorgeous.
Now, speaking of stories with sex appeal, maybe I'll get called a dirty old man for asking you this question.
Okay.
But I want to know about you going on tour with the Sports Illustrated swimsuit models, Elle McPherson, Kathy Ireland, Carol Alt, and Rachel Hunter. First of all, who did you have to fight off in the office to say, no, DeFord's doing this one?
They asked me to do it. It was the 25th anniversary of the swimsuit issue. And so the advertising guys wanted to really blow it out. And so they created, a video, and we traveled all over the country and got the private jet, the company jet. And I was the only guy on the jet, the only man, the only male.
Wow.
Except for the guy flying the plane, and he had to stay up front and fly the plane. It's me and the girls. And I had a wonderful time. It was the middle of the winter. God, it was cold. And I remember we spent Valentine's Day in Detroit, just by chance. And I gave all the girls special Valentines.
You know, the way you say that, you sounded like a dirty old man.
Well, no, I just... You know, be my Valentine. And I wasn't with my wife, so these were my Valentines. I didn't give it to just one of them. I gave it to all of them.
That's one of the great success stories of your life. Although I do have to talk about one thing. You write about this in the book, so I know it's an open subject for you. One of the failures of your life, which would be the national sports newspaper that you were editor-in-chief of in 89, 90, 91, called The National. It only lasted 18 months, mostly, I think, from reading what you wrote, because it was so hard to get it into the hands of the readers. But my question is, could something like that work today?
No. Couldn't work today. It would have even less of a chance of working today because people buy fewer newspapers. So,
could it work in an online form?
Yeah, but the trouble is that nobody's figured out how to make money online in journalism.
Yeah.
That's the great problem that we have, is that online journalism doesn't pay for itself, and all it does is kill newspapers.
Right.
News is unfortunately free, and we were talking earlier about the fact that there's not the money for investigative journalism. So there's just no way that that a sports newspaper can work until somebody can figure it. It could work online if somebody can figure out how to pay for it online.
Yep.
Well, we were a very expensive product. I mean, we had fabulous writers who were paid handsome salaries, and we had all the best facilities and all the best science and all the best technology. But what we couldn't do was we couldn't beat the 19th century.
Yeah.
Which is getting the paper from place A to place B. Newsprint is expensive, and it's heavy. And I found that out. But the chapter I write in the book, I try to be as nostalgic as possible, because there was a lot of good things. I lost $150 million, but it was a billionaire's money, and he did just fine, thank you. And he was a wonderful man, and it was a wonderful experience. On my tour for overtime, invariably, in every city, somebody has showed up who worked for the paper, and we've reminisced about what a great time it was, even if it failed.
But you also run into a lot of people, I'm sure, who say, oh, I read that every day.
Yeah.
And you know that can't be true.
And it can't be true. I couldn't read it every day. I couldn't get it every day. But people do bring copies of it to me to autograph.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of sad, because usually the copy they bring to me is the last one. So I'm signing away. But it was a great and noble adventure that we had, and I'm sorry it didn't work, but it was just unfortunately the simple 19th century business of moving newsprint from place A to place B was just too damned expensive.
Yeah. All right. On another subject, I've got a bone to pick with you. There was a documentary that came out earlier this year about poker. It's called All In. I'm a poker player, and I actually have been doing a poker radio show for about 3.5 years now, which is why I was a little bit upset when in the movie there's a scene of you saying, poker, this is just a fad. You want to explain that?
It worked for ESPN. I think it was a novelty. And those kind of secondary sports, or I don't think poker is a sport, it's a game.
Right.
But those kind of secondary sports go in and out. NASCAR, for example, has been struggling recently. It's not nearly as popular as it was just a few years ago. Fewer and fewer people are playing golf. A lot of that has to do with the fact that Tiger Woods was so popular for a while. And so any of those secondary sports are vulnerable to a lot of factors. And poker caught on, especially when ESPN got that camera that made it possible to look at the cards.
Yep. But if online poker ever gets licensed and re-regulated, I think you're going to see the boom happen again.
Could well be. And I, as a matter of fact, think America, the government, is foolish to not allow online gambling, simply because people are doing it and they're going to do it. And so the state might as well take a cut of it the way almost every other government in the world does. I think that our Puritanism is hurting us. People will bet. It's foolish, for example, to my mind, that the only place that you can legally bet on sports is in the state of Nevada.
Yep.
And why should that be? I mean, it makes no sense. It's not going to mean that Major League Baseball games or football games are going to be fixed. And yes, I know some people have gambling problems, but we tried prohibition with alcohol. It doesn't work, and it doesn't work with gambling either.
Yeah, well, part of that, to me, is a real freedom issue, which is who has the right to tell you what to do with how you spend your recreation dollars. Nobody tells you you can't buy 50 cars if you want to. But if you want to go out and bet on 50 NFL games, you're breaking the law.
It's insane, and it's stupid. I mean, that's at the end of the day, it's stupid, because it allows money that the state needs desperately to float away. Now, why are lotteries legal?
Yeah.
And lotteries, it's been proven over and over again, tend to draw from people who are least capable of paying for them. Whereas the people who bet on sports are generally have a little more money in their pocket.
Do you think that one of the reasons it doesn't happen or isn't allowed more widely is because of the power of the lobbyists who work for the NFL and the other major leagues that think that it would be harmful to them to have people betting? Maybe it would denigrate their sports?
That's the argument. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. I mean, the fact that Pete Rose is not in the Hall of Fame is because he bet on baseball, not while he was playing, but after. But even that taint, has kept him out of the Hall of Fame, which to me is equally insane. I don't know why the leagues, it's a pretense. We're going to pretend that nobody really bets on our games, and everybody knows that they do.
Yep.
And I don't see why making it legal is going to change anything. I'm not. If you're in London, you can walk down the street and walk into a betting parlor and bet a soccer game or bet Wimbledon right now. And I don't think that's, you know, damaging to soccer or tennis.
Yep. People will be able to go into bookie joints in London this summer and bet on the Olympics.
Yeah. Yes, you will.
And by the way, are you going?
No, I'm not. I'm not going because I don't have anybody to cover. It's the toughest. I'm speaking now as a journalist,
yep,
Paul. It's the toughest event for anybody to cover because it is so spread out. It's the access to the athletes is very difficult, and of course so many of them are foreign, and if you're covering one sport, I mean, in other words, if you're the guy who's covering track and field, it's reasonable. But otherwise, I think you're better to stay home and watch it on television. It's basically, Rune Arledge made it into a television show, and that's what it is. Great television show, but a television show nonetheless.
Yep.
By the way, my favorite Olympic sport is beach volleyball.
Why is that, Frank?
Because it's fun.
No.
It's really fun.
No, it's because
and
of the same reason
plays,
you wanted to do Anna Kournikova.
And it's out at the beach. I don't know where the beach is in London, but it seems to have the Olympic spirit more than anything else. That's my favorite sport.
You are a dirty old man.
Well, I didn't say it was just the women's. Now, you see, you jumped to conclusion there, Paul.
Yeah, I did.
I said beach volleyball. Yes. I didn't say women's beach volleyball.
Yeah, well.
And that's, the bodies are beautiful, but it's the male bodies as well as the female bodies that are beautiful in beach volleyball.
All right, we'll leave that as your defense then. Frank, it is a real pleasure to talk to you. As I said at the top, I've really admired your work for a long, long time. And reading some of these stories, or in some cases hearing the inside of some of these stories in the new book, is a pleasure. It's called Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. Frank, so thanks so much for your time today.
I really enjoyed it, Paul. Thank you so much.
Frank DeFore joining me here on the Big 550 KTRS.